This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I was given the title of Nutrition and Paleo Diet, and like Jim, I have battled with how to handle this, and you're going to just get what I did. I made a decision, and I've done it. So let's start with the reasons for focusing on diet. This is where I start my class on the evolution of human diet. Why do we bother to study diet? And I've just given you a series of them. Subsistence strategies result from various pressures, including interspecies competition for mates and food. In other words, so you can begin to learn something about behavior based on what the subsistence strategy is, interspecies competition for food and space, predator avoidance, and all of those things that are never considered when we try to reconstruct the behavior of some fossil species. And I'm not going to attempt to do that today, although I do think about these things in my mind. But what I am going to try to do today is to raise a couple of questions that we might want to think about when we talk about nutrition and paleo diet. So although Jim says that this is something that we shouldn't just focus on, I am going to be talking about differential survival and fertility, diet and fitness, not so much because I think they're the only way to look at something, but because food is the incredible thing that you have to survive in order to reach sexual maturity. And after that, you have to have enough food, especially the female, to feed herself and whatever fetus she's bearing, or if it's a mammal, then nursing that child afterwards. So food is incredibly necessary both for individual survival and for survival of the species. The other thing is that having been at UCSD and looking to see what kind of work Shirley Strum's been doing for 30 years, I can tell you it's absolutely incredible. So let me focus on a couple of things here. Food and reproduction, getting it right makes a difference. So differential fertility, what you have here is rainfall in the preceding months, so between 150 and 550. This is what's important for what I'm talking about. Age at the onset of sexual swelling, so that's the age at which the female can be, or male or female, can begin to bear young. And what we're looking at is a difference of almost 2 years between a low rainfall period and a high rainfall period. It's not the water per se, it's a matter of the biomass that's produced because of the rainfall. Adding on to this is a follow-up study that she did in which she's looking at an introduced opuntia. That's the opuntia from outside our area where you get those beautiful fruits and you sell them at markets here. And these baboons of Shirley's have learned how to roll the fruit in the soil, take the spines off of it, and eat it. Now, this is the rainfall, but as rainfall increases, you increase the opuntia production. The thing actually produces ripe fruits year-round. It's low in acid. 65% is simple sugar. Well, you add weight, you decrease birth spacing, which is exactly what happened with these animals, increase rain, increase output, increase or decrease the period of time at which you actually come to sexual maturity, and decrease birth spacing, and you've got a larger population than the guys next door who don't have any of these things. So it really does make a difference in terms of reproduction, just in terms of the data that my own colleague was producing. Now, differential survival. This is what we're hearing about all the time, and I think I've heard it from several people talking about paleo diet. This actually started with a graduate student at Harvard, and I just checked with Jim, and in fact, he was a graduate student at the time that Jim was there, and this is Mel Connor, who then went to Emory. And combined with his other colleague, Boyd Eaton, they put together a summary of what they found of people in the ethnographic record of what they ate, and this they called Paleolithic Nutrition. They called it that, and it was the title of the article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1985. But you go and reread that, which all my students had to do, you go back and look at that article, and they're really talking about things like sodium-potassium ratio. They're looking at whether you're eating saturated fats or not. And what we've managed to do now, of course, is go on to the paleo diet, the paleo challenge, the 7-day paleo for beginners. So you've got all of these things. Now, the thing about the paleo diet by Lauren Cordain, who was one of S. Boyd Eaton's students, it's getting a little inbred here, Lauren Cordain pointed out that these are the things we were designed to eat, designed to eat, and that these were the things that we were really selected to eat. And so that's the where it's gone with this paleo diet, almost beyond what, definitely beyond what Boyd and Eaton did originally. You got Love Paleo, health and weight loss. I even saw Diet for Children, the paleo diet for children. So I didn't put that up here. Now, in terms of what we were designed to eat, I think there might be another way of looking at that is, and that is what is around. So when we're looking at a tropical band, what is available? So in a typical West African forest, on average, this is by Hladit and Shivers, who did some amazing work back in the 90s. I also have to have my students go back and look at papers that are not necessarily online. So if you look at that, what you see is that the vast majority of available food is leaves. So you've got 12,000 kilograms of leaves compared to 23 kilograms of invertebrates and 500 kilograms of fruits. But if you look at primates, and I'll go into a little bit of why in a little bit, but when you look at primates, what are the foods that primates go for? Fruit, because it's high in energy. Insects, because they're high in protein. And leaves, because they're also high in protein. But if you look across all living primates, there are definite patterns, and that is a relationship between food and body size. So if you look at the insect eaters, they're all small, very small. This is something you hold in your hand. Microcebus is one of the tiniest primates, and it's almost fully insectivorous. The large animals can survive on leaves, so mountain gorilla is about the only one that survives totally on leaves. But most of them combine them with fruit in order to get the energy because you can't get enough from these others. So you've got frugivore, insectivore, which are sort of on the smallest side. You have frugivore, folivores, which are on the larger side. Humans, we fall into the frugivore, folivore, but not many of us are folivores. If you look at it another way, this was John Flegel's description. What he did is he showed insectivores and folivores. There's some fairly pure folivores. We won't talk about those. Those are colobine monkeys. Frugivores, total frugivores, but most of them are going to be mixed, fruit and insects or fruit and leaves. Where are humans? This is where we are. We're almost up by the gorilla, which can eat just leaves, and we don't. So do you think I'm going to give you an answer? No. The question is why? Why are we so different? So where we have to go is back into the fossil record, as Bill said, and I'm really, I'm not a paleontologist, but we definitely need more information from the fossil record, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples. One is an archaic primate called Carpalestes. The next one is Egyptopithecus, and it is at the base of the division between monkeys and apes, so you've got the combination there. You've got Proconsul, which is at the base of the apes. It's going to be. Then you have Ardipithecus, and depending on where you put that position, there is a very different interpretation, and mine will be different from Bill's because I put the time period in a different place than he did. So let's move on. Carpalestes. This is a mouse-sized primate, lived 58 million years ago, and it was an almost complete skeleton. And it's incredible. Been reconstructed and now reconstructed. Arboreal, as someone else was pointing out. These are all arboreal. We are also arboreal primates. But the thing that's so incredible about this primate is its hand. Because what that is doing is it has hands on both the forefeet and the hind feet, as was pointed out. And what that thing can do is grab and pull something toward it. So it doesn't have to jump in the trees, which was the other idea. They jumped after insects. It actually can pull toward it. It does not have complete three-dimensional vision, but it's enough of an overlap that when it pulls toward it, it knows exactly where that thing is in space. So that's a baseline primate, is to be able to pull something toward you and feed on it, which is usually a fruit, which is the energy. Let's jump to 30 million years ago. And believe me, I did select these on purpose, because to me, these are really critical divisions, what happens here. They are prior to the division between the apes and the old world monkeys. But the thing that's of most interest is that it does not look like an early monkey. It has a body like a monkey. It moves around in the trees. It's arboreal. It grabs. But it has a head like an ape. So this is not like anything alive today. This is something completely different. And if we're going to look at the evolution of diet, we have to think about these animals, not just the ones that are alive today. Today, this is what the area looks like. Back then, this is what it looked like. It was a forest. It had they had crocodiles there, snakes, various things like that. Thank you. So here we go. We got Egyptopithecus in the trees as a fairly large primate. We move another millions of years to proconsul, baseline ape. Again, it is a monkey-like body, and it's got an ape-like head. So the teeth look like apes, the head looks like an ape, the body is moving around just like a monkey without a tail. And what we know from the biochemistry of it, what we know from the microware of it, everything, we know it's tree living, and it's fleshy fruits and leaves. Now, depending on where you put that line, Ardipithecus is at the base of chimpanzees and humans, or where Bill put it was up where humans and not with chimpanzees. That gives you the interpretation that the last common ancestor was a knuckle walker. Keep in mind that the two knuckle walkers in Africa do not do it the same way. So gorillas do not knuckle walk the same way chimpanzees do. And the way in which Tim White interpreted this is that the last common ancestor could just as easily have been a biped as a knuckle walker. If you think about it that way, that gives you a slightly different way of thinking about diets. So whether or not that's what turns out to be correct, we ought to at least think about that as an option. Pan was a knuckle walker. Ardipithecus was a facultative upright walker. Highly accomplished climber, Pan. It was competent, Ardipithecus. Enlarged incisors for eating fruit? Yes, fruit eating. That's what all primates do. And the Ardipithecus, woodland to forest, omnivore and fruit eater. If we just go through these, we get very fleshy fruits, nut-like oil seeds, in the early ones. And this comes from bone chemistry. It also comes from morphology. If you look at the very robust Australopithecine, what you find is that they're probably adding in things like these sedges, which no self-respecting primate eats like that. In fact, I'm ready to take them out of the primate order, based on diet. If you then look at these others, the Australopithecines, the later ones, you're looking at things with some grass in it, but mostly, again, fleshy fruits and leaves. You move into the more recent ones, and what you're getting are berries, grasses, roots, nuts, a whole mixture of things. And if we look at the very early Homo, what we're finding is a modern body size. We think they're eating meat. And what I want to leave you with here is why. We still don't know why. It's not because meat's that easily digested. Yes, it's good for us. There's not much fat on it in a desert. So going forward, before we can answer anything, I'll just go through these extremely quickly. More fossils. I would put it at the late Miocene, the mid to late Miocene. We definitely need to know that. Between 4.4 and now, we don't have that many fossils. We need to have more studies on gut microbiota and how it varies across primates. How, and this is one of the things that Alyssa will be talking a little bit later, but she and a colleague, Schnorr, actually did have been starting to look at this in the Hadza. Genetic, physiological, morphological adaptations of primates to different at different subsistence strategies. And finally, I'll give a shout out for Richard Wrangham. We need to know more about when controlled use of fire occurred and when cooking began to occur, because we are the only animal that cooks. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to be here today, and I would like to congratulate the directors of CARTA for an amazing organization, and I've really enjoyed coming to the seminars over the past 10 years. It's been a real pleasure. So today I've been tasked with the job of providing an overview on ancient DNA research, and so I will attempt to do that. And really, ancient DNA is a toolbox. It's a way that we can try to pull genetic information from the past and make inferences about evolutionary history. And it's a field that's about 35 years old and is really standing on the shoulders of technological advances, particularly initially with PCR, and it was very much stimulated by that work. The first ancient archaic human DNA was published in 1997, and in that paper, we reported the results of mitochondrial DNA. We very laboriously PCR'd small fragments, put them together, and compared it to modern human variation. And at the time, we concluded that it was very unlikely that humans interbred with Neanderthals. Now, if you've been following the news, I'm sure you know that we were not right, and that's actually what's so exciting, right? There have been so many technological advances that have enabled us to look at complete genomes and put together a more complete story. And so the Neanderthal Genome Project really pushed a lot of these technological advances. And in the last 10 years, in addition to next-generation sequencing, methods of really pulling out tiny fragments of DNA. So as opposed to long reads, like Evan was talking about, we're looking at really short reads. And a lot of the methods we were using, we're actually losing a lot of the shortest fragments that we now can recover. And we can take that DNA, and when we extract DNA from a sample, we're extracting all the DNA. And what we do is we make a library. And this library has various indices and tags on it that let us then amplify it, almost immortalize it. And we can then use our library and sort of go fishing. And we go fishing using probes that capture the DNA we're interested in. That might be a whole genome. It might be a pathogen. And then to those little baits, we can attach magnetic beads and then, through the beauty of magnetism, pull that DNA to the side of the tube and wash the DNA that we're not so interested in away. So this enrichment really has fostered our ability to address questions about human population history over the last 500,000 years now. After enrichment, we have sequencing. And I should also say that advancements in bioinformatics have been equally important. So we're now using methods of machine learning to try to make inferences about population history. So what do we know for certain? Because of the Neanderthal Genome Project and subsequent discoveries, we know that in Eurasia, archaic humans had pretty small effective population sizes and more inbreeding than we see in modern human or in humans today. Interbreeding was more common than we thought, right? So we were incorrect from the mitochondrial perspective, because once we look at the full genome sequence, we can actually see evidence for interbreeding among different populations. We also see that there were some adaptive alleles that are the result of gene flow from archaic humans. So in 2010, with a low coverage genome from a Neanderthal, we were able to see that inbreeding did in fact happen, and make estimates of population divergence, and also look at, get some idea of what genes perhaps distinguish the lineages. Now, one thing that has been really amazing is that from Denisova Cave, we have both Neanderthal and Denisovans. Who are they, right? Who are really providing fascinating information about past human evolutionary history and essentially surprising us about it almost daily, I think. But so here you can see that this particular cave has really amazing preservation. And what's great about it, it's allowed us to get high coverage genomes. Now, 1x coverage, there's a lot of problems about making inferences that you're statistically confident in. But once you have a 52x, a 30x, depth of coverage, so the number of sequencing reads on average at a site is very high, and so your confidence statistically is higher. And so this enables you to really make much more sophisticated analyses about population history. So for example, at Denisova Cave, you can see here comparisons of genetic diversity along chromosomes. And what you'll notice is the French, there's a lot of as your sort of average European here, there's a lot of diversity as you compare along the chromosome. Denisovan, there's still some, but less. But you'll notice the Neanderthal in particular has quite a few stretches that where there's very little to no diversity. And this is telling us that inbreeding or population sizes were much smaller. So these are some of the many fascinating things that have come out of the genome projects related to Neanderthals and Denisovans. We've also learned a lot about population history in the last 10,000 years. And the place we probably know the most about is Europe. There have been a huge number of studies. We now have, I think, hundreds of genomes from ancient Europeans. And what this has shown us is that there's been a lot more gene flow and replacement than we expected. So early populations in Europe, represented on this map, the hunter-gatherer populations, which would have been represented by the blue color, and they actually don't show individuals just from that group. But once the farmers come in, you'll notice that you get almost a replacement in some areas. However, this ancient hunter-gatherer ancestry sort of makes a resurgence after a bit. Probably gets pushed to the edges, but then through interbreeding, gets mixed into the European gene flow, gene pool. Then you see the Yamnaya, these Eurasian steppe populations, coming in the Bronze Age with a very strong signature that persists today. And I think that was very surprising to many people. We also learn a lot about patterns of adaptation over time. And I think people often ask, oh, so humans have stopped evolving, right? And this is one of the major problems, well, there's many, with the Paleolithic diet, right? It assumes that we haven't changed since the Paleolithic. And in fact, we have. So one of the examples would be lactase persistence. right? The ability to digest milk. And so this is a cheese strainer from 5,000 years ago in Poland. And, you know, what you see over time is that this sort of red color, this is the lactase persistence allele. It's very low early on, but then increases quite rapidly. We also see what looks like shifts in patterns of pigmentation. There's some estimates that perhaps early Europeans actually had darker skin and blue eyes, and that the skin color lightened through time. There's some debates about this because the inference of past alleles is often very difficult, what the phenotype would be. And so that's one of the challenges, of course, is to try to infer function and then phenotype. We also see, of course, strong selection at genomic loci involved in the immune system. That's a constant pressure. And the new methods in ancient DNA analyses are also allowing us to look at human pathogen interactions. This is a very vague statement, and that's kind of for a reason. And that's because we often find what we don't expect. So this slide could be called the Black Death and the White Plague because, you know, people assumed that the plague didn't really appear until the first great pandemic, the Justinian Plague. But in fact, we've learned that it's much older, and we can actually see the different changes in the pathogen. We also surprisingly learned that while plague is older than we thought, TB is younger than we thought, and it was actually brought to the Americas via seals. This was not expected. So what are we not sure about? A lot. Was there hybrid incompatibility? How much gene flow was there? And what about populations in places where we don't have good ancient DNA evidence? So we also know that there have been major shifts perhaps in other parts of the world since the Neolithic, and how much is this true outside of Europe? And also, you know, how do the patterns of pathogen, how do pathogens change pre and post agriculture? As I said, just a brief example, people are applying different methods to try to make inferences about the number of gene flow events. Kulveem et al. Found estimated 6. Mondal et al. Recently have used machine learning to estimate additional events of interbreeding, and these ghost populations also become quite intriguing. What else do we need to know, and how do we proceed? Well, who were the Denisovans? What's their range? Were there additional archaic hominins that contribute ancestry? And how do we detect this? Katerina Dudka and others are applying zooarchaeology by mass spectroscopy to try to identify what species little fragments are at archaeological sites and then use the DNA to gain further information, particularly in places where ancient DNA is harder to come by, but also full-size remains are hard to come by. Other questions relate to the adaptive legacy, and in particular related to complex traits. So a lot of the low-hanging fruit of simple traits has, you know, been looked at. But of course, you know, more complex traits like cognition are of great interest, and even epigenetic analyses. And we can make inferences about epigenetics based on the damage patterns in the DNA. This is work by David Gockman and Laurent Carmel's lab. And this has, intriguingly, in a paper that's been submitted, highlighted the vocal tract and face as having major differences between modern humans and archaic humans. Finally, where and to what extent are we expected to find pathogens in archaeological material? You know, pathogens hang out in different parts of the body. So there's a lot of pathogens we're never going to learn about from ancient DNA because they just don't hang out in the bones or the teeth. What are the population dynamics through time? How do we understand the microbiome and its changes? And that's, I think, a very intriguing area of research. And we're learning that there are major differences, perhaps based on diet. But we know, for example, that rural populations and first world populations have quite different gut microbiomes. And meanwhile, here are the apes. And so why are these ecologies different? And what's the functional importance there? So, for example, the red complex in humans has been related to periodontal disease, but it's also quite common in other apes. This is my postdoc who's been working on this. And so what does this mean in terms of, you know, do we see the same type of evidence in other human populations as well as our closest relatives? And how do we look at this both over time and across different populations? So work in science, of course, is done with big teams, and so I have to thank my laboratory and funders and you for your attention. Thank you.
So I'm really excited to be here today to celebrate the 10th anniversary of CARTA, and I've been charged with talking about human population genetics, but I'm going to focus on evolution and adaptation in Africa. So let me start with what I think are some of the key challenges in human evolutionary genomics research. The first is that we simply need to do a better job characterizing genomic and phenotypic variation in ethnically diverse populations from around the world. We need to understand the evolutionary processes that generate and maintain that variation. We need to better understand, where did modern humans originate in Africa? What was their demographic history? And how did modern humans adapt to changes in environment and diet during human evolution? So let me start with something that we absolutely know, which is that modern humans originated in Africa. These red dots represent the sites of fossils of anatomically modern humans, the oldest of which was dated to 300,000 years ago. What we need to know is still we need a better idea of when and where did modern humans originate in Africa, because there's a major bias that we're not finding fossils in tropical areas, for example. So this is still an outstanding question. We also think that after modern humans originated in Africa, that relatively small numbers migrated out of Africa within the past 100,000 years, giving rise to populations across the globe. But what we need to know were things like how many migrations were there. So, for example, could there have been a southern migration route into South Asia and Australomelanesia in addition to a northern route? And what were the source populations in Africa? Now, as you just heard from Anne, we think we know now, it's pretty certain, I would say, that after modern humans left Africa, they intermixed or interbred with archaic populations like Neanderthals and Denisovans. But a big outstanding question is, was there admixture with archaic populations in Africa? My own research and that of some other teams suggest that there was, but because, we don't have those fossils that are preserved well, we don't have ancient DNA, so it's a very tricky question to address at this point. This is from a paper, a perspective we just published, I think came out about 2 days ago in Cell, and it's pointing out that there's a major European bias in human genomic studies. So the figure on the right here is showing the number of individuals by ethnicity included in genome-wide association studies that look for an association with variable traits or disease. It's in your glossary if you want to look. And almost 80% are Europeans. The numbers for Hispanics is 1%, Africans 2%, a bit more Asian representatives, about 10%, and then everybody else less than 1%. So this is problematic for a number of reasons. One is in terms of biomedical knowledge, that it could exacerbate health disparities. But secondly, in terms of what we can learn about human evolutionary history. So to help alleviate those disparities, myself and my African collaborators have been doing field work in Africa for the past 18 or so years. We're collecting biological samples from blood, DNA, and RNA, and plasma. And we're getting detailed ethnographic information, information about diet. And then we have the challenge of processing these in areas where there's no electricity. So what you could see on the bottom left here is that we now bring a generator with us. We just set up this bush lab. And we try to measure phenotypic diversity, including very detailed anthropometric traits like height and weight and limb length and skin pigmentation. We look at cardiovascular, lung, and blood phenotypes. We look at metabolic function, lactose tolerance, glucose tolerance, and infectious disease status when we can. So this is from a study that we published a number of years ago looking at genome-wide variation over 3,000 Africans from 121 ethnic groups, but it remains one of the largest studies of ethnically diverse populations in Africa. What we know is that you can see these different colors. These are genetically inferred ancestral populations. So all the colors are telling you there is a lot of genetic diversity between African populations. They also have the highest levels of genetic diversity within populations compared to the rest of the world. And that's just representing their demographic history and adaptation to different environments. This is a new study coming out soon in genome biology, consisting of a whole genome sequencing in 94 individuals from 44 African populations. And from this, we can make a phylogenetic tree. So we can look at how populations are related to each other based on genetic similarities. And what I could say that we know for certain, and all other studies have shown this actually, that the San populations, who traditionally have practiced hunting and gathering, and they speak with cliques, and they live in southern Africa, they have the oldest genetic lineages in the world, followed by the rainforest hunter-gatherers in Central Africa, commonly referred to as pygmies. We've also used computational approaches to try to estimate when these populations diverge from each other. And we know that the oldest divergence is between the San and all other populations, but we see that populations in Africa have been subdivided for a long time. So, for example, even two San populations that speak slightly different languages have been diverged for about 30,000 years. However, we need to develop better models that take into account really complex demographic histories that include things like migration and gene flow and divergence. This is from another review paper that we published a couple of years ago showing examples of local adaptation. One that you may be familiar, I think there was some mention of it earlier, is lactose tolerance, which we showed evolved independently in East African pastoralists relative to Europeans. And as you heard Anne say, actually, a real challenge is to understand molecular mechanisms of human adaptation, particularly for complex traits that are caused by multiple genes. So I'm going to give you an example, a recent example, of our study of the genetics of skin color, which is thought to be an adaptive trait, and is caused by, influenced by multiple genes. So on the left is inferred melanin levels. So melanin is the pigment in skin that makes it darker, and from global populations. And we could see it's very correlated with UV levels, so it's thought this is an adaptive trait. And it's thought that when modern humans left Africa and they migrated to higher latitudes, there would have been selection for lighter skin to facilitate the production of vitamin D, which is synthesized in the skin in response to UV. And in places closer to the equator, there would have been selection for darker skin to prevent cancer, skin cancer, and also folate degradation. Folate's very important for development. But most studies have been done in European populations, and little's known about the genetics of skin color in African populations. So to alleviate this bias, we inferred skin color by using a machine, a spectrophotometer, where we basically shine light underneath the arm, so that's an area that's not exposed so much to sunlight. And we look at the reflection, the wavelengths, the light that's reflected, and from that we can infer the melanin levels. And what we find is the San, who have the oldest genetic lineages, are the most lightly pigmented people in Africa. We see a wide range of skin color, with the most darkly pigmented being the Nilotic pastoralists, who originated from southern Sudan. We then looked at over 4 million variable sites across the genome, and we did a genome-wide association study, and we found 8 independent loci or regions, variants associated with skin color that are in 4 major regions at a genome-wide level of significance. So I'm just going to go through those quickly. So the top association is at a gene called SLC2485, and this was actually the very first gene that was identified to be associated with light skin in Europeans. There's a non-synonymous variant in this gene, and in these figures, the circles that are light-colored are showing the frequency of the variants associated with light skin color, or that blue, I should say, are those that are associated with light skin color. And we can see that this is at almost 100% frequency in Europeans, very common in Pakistan and India, and also in East Africa. So one of the questions we had is, well, did this arise independently in Africa? And one of the ways we can address that is to make something called a haplotype network. So a haplotype is simply how different variants are arranged along a short region of a chromosome. And these circles represent different haplotypes. The size of the circle represents the number, and the colors represent proportion in different populations. And it's sort of a phylogenetic reconstruction because these haplotypes are very different. They have a lot of different mutations, for example, from this haplotype. So what we see is that this non-synonymous variant is on one common long haplotype in Europeans, consistent with recent strong selection. But East Africans have this variant on exactly the same haplotype background. So that means it had to have been introduced by migration back into Africa. The second strongest association was at a gene called MFSD12 that had never previously been characterized. We found two independent associations. One is in a regulatory region upstream of the gene MFSD12 that is influencing expression of the gene. And the other are variants within the gene that we actually think are playing a role in expression as well. And what we could see is that for the variant in the regulatory region upstream, the variant associated with light skin is at nearly 100% frequency in Europeans, East Asians, and it's very common in East Africans and actually in the San as well. So we collaborated with Bill Pavin at NIH, and he used CRISPR-Cas9 technology to knock this gene out in the mouse, and it had a pretty dramatic effect. So it caused this sort of brown-yellow agouti mouse to lose the, came gray. So basically what we find is that Africans have lower levels of this and darker skin, and then has the opposite effect on pheomelanin, which causes more yellow-colored skin. We can then estimate the age of these different mutations. This is, again, just like a phylogeny, and lineages that have the light allele are shown with open circles, and those with the dark allele are shown here. In this case, the ancestral allele is the one associated with light skin color, and the ages of both alleles are very old, on the order of a million years. The next locus where we saw an association was at DDB1. This plays a critical role in DNA mismatch repair in response to UV. So if people have mutations in the proteins that this interacts with, they have a disease called xeroderma pigmentosum. They can't be exposed to sunlight at all because they'll get skin cancer. Now, what does that have to do with color in humans? We don't know, but this happens to be the gene that causes the color of tomatoes. So it has something to do with pigmentation. Again, we see two independent associations of this gene. When you look at the haplotype network, we're also seeing evidence of a very strong selective sweep outside of Africa. This is one really common long haplotype. And in fact, if you look at the gene genealogy, all of the lineages outside of Africa with the light-associated allele, they coalesce at around 60,000 years ago, the time of migration of modern humans out of Africa. So when that light allele was introduced, it swept almost 100% frequency for reasons we don't know. And then the last region is OCA2, HERC2. Variants in HERC2 were known to be associated with skin color and eye color in Europeans, but we found an independent association. And we showed that they influence the expression of the OCA2 gene. But we also found a variant within OCA2, within exon 10, which is a synonymous variant. It doesn't cause an amino acid change. But it was in a region that has been known to have mutations that cause albinism. And it turns out that the variant that is associated with light skin has alternative splicing. A part of the protein, basically, is missing that plays a very critical role. There's still a protein, but it has a very altered function. And in this case, we see evidence for balancing selection, that different lineages have been maintained for a long time. So what does this tell us about the origins of skin color? Well, I want to point out that at half of the loci, the variants that we found, the ancestral allele is the light-associated allele. Furthermore, most of these are older than the origin of modern humans. So this poor chimp lost its hair due to a skin disorder, but has relatively light skin, although I did see some images earlier of darkly pigmented chimps. I don't know. We'll have to discuss that later. But anthropologists have argued that this would have been the ancestral state, and that when modern humans left the trees and went into the savanna, there would have been selection for decrease in body hair and increase in sweat glands for thermoregulation, and then there would have been selection for darker skin. But we've shown that both dark and light alleles variants have been around for a long time, so we don't know exactly how darkly pigmented they were. And the last point I'll show is another outstanding question has been, what accounts for the dark skin color in South Asians and Australomelanesians? At the regions we studied, we found that they had the identical variants that we found in Africans, suggesting they were introduced by migration. But it's still an outstanding question whether they have other variants that play a role. So how do we proceed in the future? We need to include more ethnically diverse populations in studies of genomic and phenotypic variation. We need better computational approaches to infer complex demographic histories and identify targets of natural selection, particularly for complex traits. And we need better functional genomic approaches to identify causal genetic variants that are influencing these traits. And I will just stop by thanking everybody who contributed.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.